Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by WonderFest, the Bay Area Beacon of Science. My name is Tucker Hyatt. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Allison Gopnik, Professor of Psychology and Affiliate Professor of Philosophy at UC Berkeley, and author of The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. Dr. Gopnik is an internationally recognized expert in children's learning and development. She received her BA from McGill University and her PhD from Oxford University. Dr. Gopnik has authored 5 books and over 100 academic articles. She also writes the monthly Mind and Matter column for the Wall Street Journal. And she has received numerous awards, including distinguished fellowships at Stanford, at Caltech, and at Oxford. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Allison Gopnik.
So what I want to do briefly to start out before we have a conversation is just give you a sense of some of the science that my colleagues and I have been doing over the past 30 years, looking at how children learn and how children relate to parents. And part of the reason why I wrote this book is that the picture that comes out of that science is very different from a kind of standard picture that we see in the culture about the relationship between children and parents. It's encapsulated by that word parenting. This is a New Yorker cartoon that kind of gets the essence of what the parenting picture is all about. She's saying which one generates the most synapses. Now, parenting is such a deep part of our culture that it may seem as if it's always been there. But in fact, the very word is a relatively recent invention. So if you look at the Google Ngram, that's 1970, and it was only around 1970 that the word even appeared at all as a verb. Of course, mothers and fathers and parents, that's as old as English. But the idea that there was this special activity, this special thing that you did that was called parenting, that's a really recent invention. And it comes with a particular kind of picture of the relation between parents and children that I think of as being this kind of carpentry picture. You have to pay attention to the materials you have, but if you just get the right expertise, the right knowledge, the right kinds of tips and techniques, you'll be able to shape your child into a particular kind of adult. And that has become very much the dominant picture of what the relations between parents and children are all about. And as I say, it's a very different picture than the picture that comes from the science. Well, what kind of picture does come from the science? Well, one of the questions that we can ask scientifically is, why is it that we have children at all? Not the obvious answer, which probably most of the people in this room have figured out, although sometimes when I give talks down in the valley, it's not so obvious. But why is it that we have this very long period of childhood? And our childhood is longer than the childhood of any other species. So this is an adorable 7-year-old chimp. And by the time this chimp is 7, chimps are producing as much food as they're consuming. So they're already pretty independent at that point. Whereas if you look even in forager or hunter-gatherer cultures, humans aren't doing that until they're 15 at the youngest. And my son is 27, and nowadays, even when they're 27, we're still paying rent checks and tuition. So as soon as we evolved as human beings, we evolved with these very expensive children, these children who required a tremendous investment from caregivers. Why is it that we see this extremely long period of childhood with the really difficult investment that goes with it? Well, the answer seems to be that when you look across many, many different kinds of animals, you see this really striking relationship between how long a childhood the animals have and how large a brain, how generally speaking smart, the adult animal is. And the sort of poster animals for this are actually birds. So, for example, this is a New Caledonian crow, and crows and corvids and ravens and so forth in general, are incredibly smart birds. These New Caledonian crows are as smart as chimpanzees. So this is a bird that's actually learned how to bend a piece of wire to get food. In contrast, here's our friend the domestic chicken, and with apologies to chicken lovers in the audience, which we sort of have to say in Berkeley, chickens are basically dumb as stumps. So chickens are very good at pecking for grain. They're not much good at doing anything else. The chicken babies are mature within a couple of weeks. The crows aren't mature are fledglings for as long as a year, and these New Caledonian crows are fledglings for as long as 2 years. So really long time in the life of a bird. And this isn't just true about crows and chickens, it's true about mammals, it's true about marsupials. It's very generalization across the animal kingdom. What seems to happen is that some animals, like the chicken, are beautifully adapted to one particular environment. They're very good at dealing with the grain-pecking environment. Other animals, like the crow, aren't so well adapted to any one particular environment, but they're very good at dealing with new environments. They're very good at dealing with change. They're very good at dealing with unpredictable new problems. So that, for example, the crow can take this wire that he's never seen before and figure out how to use it as a tool. And the solution to those two different kind of evolutionary problems seems to be that the crow is very good at learning. Not very good at doing anything in particular, very good at learning to do new things in new circumstances. And we human beings are kind of way out on the end of the distribution on all of those dimensions. So we have the largest brains. We're, in some sense, the smartest, certainly the most flexible. We learn the most. We can learn about more different environments than any other animal. And our babies are immature for longer than those of any other species. Okay, why would this be? Well, actually, looking at the crows can help to give us some clues, because what is it that the crows are doing in that period? Basically, what the crows are doing is trying and failing. So what the crows will do is start to try to do something like make a digging tool that they can use to get termites out of a hole, and they'll do it all wrong. They'll do it with the thin end at the back instead of the front end, and they'll pull the barbs off from the top instead of the bottom. But during that period when they're trying and failing, as again people down in the valley know, failing fast is the way to learn. That's the way to succeed. The downside of that strategy of trying and failing and trying and failing and learning, is that in that period you need to be protected. You need to have a mom who will sit there and kind of tap her foot and drop termites and tuition checks into your mouth. And human beings seem to be the best example of that. One of the ways that I put it sometimes is that children are really the research and development division of the human species, and we're production and marketing. So they get this protected period where they can just be blue sky creative, think of lots of different kinds of solutions without actually having to worry about making a profit. And we take all that exploration that we did when we were children and we put it to use to do all the things that we need to do as adults. Now, if this picture is true, you'd expect to see it reflected in the brain, and in fact, you do. So this is a chart that shows the number of new synapses that are being developed at various periods of development. And you can see that there's this early period, sort of corresponding to early childhood, to the preschool period, when many, many, many new connections are being formed. And then there's this late period, a sort of tipping point, somewhere around 5, depending on the area of the brain you're talking about, where the connections that have already been formed become strong and efficient, and the connections that aren't used just kind of disappear. They're pruned. And what that means is that you have an early brain that's very much what neuroscientists call plastic, very flexible, very good at learning, very sensitive to information from the environment. And then you have a later brain that's very efficient and effective, very good at getting things done, not so good at changing, at learning, at dealing with change, at dealing with new environments. And you can even see this when you look at the expense of that brain. This is one of my favorite recent studies. So as you may know, as you're sitting here right now, your brain is using about 20% of your calories. So brains are basically Macs. They're very expensive computing gadgets to carry around. What they did in this study was to look at the developmental trajectory, and what they discovered is that when you're four, your brain is using up 66% of your calories. So that's kind of the maximum period. So not only is childhood expensive, that childhood brain is expensive. It gives me a kind of lovely picture of my four-year-old grandson, Augie, who I think of now as being like a kind of Doctor Who villain with this, he's basically this giant hungry brain with little arms and legs attached to it that has developed techniques for turning us all into his slave and making sure we do nothing but feed this hungry brain more and more. So if this picture that I've been talking about is right, we might expect that young children would come equipped with really distinctive, powerful learning mechanisms that they could use in this early period, and particularly learning mechanisms that would allow them to think up new ideas, to be creative, to deal with potential new environments. And that's just what my colleagues and I have been exploring in our lab at Berkeley. And we do this with very simple devices. This is a Plicky detector. It's a box that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it and not other things on it. But with this very simple device, we can show just how smart children are at learning about the world from patterns of statistics and evidence, the same way that scientists do. And you guys can be subjects in a little Plicky detector experiment now. So here's a Plicky detector. The question is, which ones are Plickets? Here's D that goes on the detector three times and nothing happens. Here's E that goes on the detector and nothing happens. D and F together go on and the machine lights up. D and F go on together and the machine lights up. And in the experiment, these are all different. The D and F are just different shapes of the Plickets. So the question is D a Plicket? Okay. Is E a Plicket? Is F a Plicket? Okay, great. So as I would expect, people at the Commonwealth Club are as smart as Berkeley undergraduates, but maybe not as smart as four-year-olds, because what if you also saw this series of events? So you saw A, B, and C go on separately, and nothing happens. A and C go on, and the detector lights up. A and B go on, and nothing happens. B and C go on, and nothing happens. Now, if you went back to that original sequence, you might think, oh, no, wait a minute. I thought this machine worked the obvious way. Either something is a Plicket or it isn't. But maybe what happens is that you need to have two Plickets to actually make the machine go. Maybe this machine works on this unusual, kind of non-obvious principle. And if I discovered that about the machine, then I might say, oh, no, actually, D and F are both Plickets. So what we did was we did exactly the experiment I just did with you, with Berkeley undergraduates and four-year-olds. So we either gave them information that suggested that the machine worked on this disjunctive OR principle, these individual blocks made it go, or else this much less likely, less obvious solution to the problem, that it was the combinations that made it go, and then we tested them. And what we discovered was that even four-year-olds, and we've recently done this in Head Start and in rural Peru, and the same thing is true. Even four-year-olds solve this problem. If you give them information that tells them the obvious hypothesis is right, they go with that. But if you give them information that tells them this sort of unusual, non-obvious hypothesis is right, then they go with that. So if you give them the training that this is a combination machine, then they'll say that both D and F are Plickets. We do this with undergraduates. They're really good at finding the obvious solution. And then you give them the information that points to the non-obvious solution, and they give you the obvious solution anyway. Mm-hmm. So undergraduates and adults in general are very good at using the evidence to solve the problem in an obvious way. They're much less good than the four-year-olds at finding this unlikely, creative, novel solution. And sort of the picture that comes from the evolution is that's the whole point of childhood. The whole point of childhood is to give us this period where we can do this wide-ranging exploration, think of new ideas, figure out new things about the world around us. Let me give you one more example of this. So we, again, wanted to see if children could get to a creative solution to a problem. And this time what we did was we gave them an imitation task. So here's how it goes. Again, it's just a little toy, and you can do different things to it, like you can squish the toy, and you can squeeze the bulb, and you can pull the ring. And what the children see is they see an adult do three actions in succession, like they squish the toy, they squeeze the bulb, they pull the ring, and the machine plays music. Or else they pull the handle, and they squeeze the bulb, and they pull the ring, and the machine plays music. Now, if you saw those two sequences, you might just imitate what the adult did, but you might also make a creative solution, which is to just squeeze the bulb and pull the ring. You might figure out that you really only have to do those last two things. And if you were a good statistician who was analyzing that evidence, that's what you would conclude. And again, that's exactly what four-year-olds conclude.
It is. Isn't it crazy? Yeah, I've never played with it before. So you know what's funny about it? It plays music. But I don't know how to make it play music yet, so I thought that what we could do is we could try some things and see if we can figure it out, okay? You want to help me see if we can figure out what makes it go? All right, so that's going to be your game. We'll see. What makes my new toy play music? What should I try? All right, well, what if I squish it, and then I squeeze it here, and then I pull this ring. Oh! Play music!
Little boy, so
should I try that again? All right. I'll squish it, and then I'll squeeze it here, and then I'll pull this ring. Hey! I think I should try something else. I'll try something else. What if I squish it, and then I shake it, and then I pull this ring? Do you hear anything? No, I don't hear anything either.
Okay, so she does that 10 more times, and then at the end of that process, she actually gives the toy to the little boy to try and see what he's going to do. And as you can see, he squeezes the bulb, and he pulls the ring. So he actually has figured out the creative solution to that task. Now, here's the interesting thing. As you may have noticed, Daphna, my student who came from MIT Computer Science, was very good at being clueless in this context. She said, I don't know how this works. Let's just find out how it works. We did the study exactly the same way, except that this time she said, this is my toy. I'm going to show you how it works. So she acted like a teacher or like one of those carpentry parents, trying to shape the children to come out a particular way. When she did that, the children imitated exactly what she did. They never got to the creative solution. So zero on the bar chart. So I think the conclusion from this, and there's much, much more, which you can read about in the book, is that caregivers care not so children can be shaped to come out a particular way, but so children can explore. So even if it was possible to accomplish this parenting carpentry end of shaping our children to come out in to be a particular way, we would have defeated the whole purpose of childhood by doing it. Because the whole purpose of childhood is to have this protected period when children can create, deal with, generate new ideas about the world and new ways of coping with the world. So let me end there, but let me just show in the background. So if people, you know, want to know what could you do to create that sort of garden, to give children that kind of chance, I think we've actually known this for a pretty long time. I mean, after all, the very word kindergarten started out by being about a child's garden. And in the course of writing the book, in fact, actually after I wrote the book, I found this wonderful silent film from the 1920s of the Child Study Center at Berkeley, showing what they did in Berkeley in 1923 to create a garden for children. And I'll just let this play in the background as we talk. But intuitively, those preschool teachers in the 1920s, those kindergarten teachers and preschool teachers now, I think know what you need to do. You create a rich space, lots of exploration, lots of grown-ups around who care about the children. And that kind of child's garden, that kindergarten, is the way that we can take advantage of this amazing part of our human heritage, our long and extended childhood. So let me stop there and you can see the children. You can see the children playing with geese and also saws and hammers and nails and things that would get us into tremendous trouble if we tried to do them in the preschool nowadays. And join Julie for conversation.
Hi, I'm Julie Lithcott-Hames. I'm the author of How to Raise an Adult. Delighted to be here with Dr. Allison Gopnik. Delighted to be here with the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and Wonderfest. And I got to say, Dr. Gopnik, or should I call you Allison?
Call me Allison.
Call you Allison. Don't you love that? I got to say, you had me at hello. And the hello for me was when I read a piece you had written for either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, a little excerpt of this marvelous book, The Gardener and the Carpenter. I thought just from the title, yes, she gets it. And then, of course, I read the book, and I've got it totally marked up, and I encourage everybody to get a copy. Get yours signed, as I just did. But there's a lovely quote here toward the back that says, the morality of being a parent is about taking a creature who isn't autonomous and can't make his own decisions and turning him into one who can. At this point, I'm sort of shaking my fists in the air saying I love this woman, because I go around talking about my book and I say, you know, our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job.
Right.
We're not meant to foster dependence. We're supposed to be teaching them skills. So I think my first question for you, and the format, by the way, is I'm going to ask a few questions, and then someone's going to signal that time is nigh, and we're going to open it up to questions from you guys, and you're turning them in as we talk. Okay. So here we have the improbable. A professor at Berkeley, a former dean from Stanford, can agree on something, and that is that maybe too many young people today are the victims of what we call parenting, right? The verb parenting, relatively new in our American lexicon. I came at this awareness, being a dean of freshmen, working with other people's kids, noticing, too many of the students seem to be very reliant on their parents to handle tasks that college students used to always be able to handle. Gee, the students don't seem to mind. Gee, the students seem kind of existentially impotent. And then, gee, or worse, stuff you can't say on the radio, I'm doing it to my own kids here in Palo Alto, okay? So I've got this dual vantage point of dean by day, parent by night. My aha moment actually came in my own house when I connected the dots and realized I was doing this over parenting with my kids. What was your aha moment?
Well, when I originally started writing this book, I really wanted to write a book like my previous books that was about the science, because there's been all this exciting work in evolutionary biology and in developmental psychology about how creative children are. And at just about the same time, I became a grandmother. And watching my children raising their children and watching their children growing up in the world of child rearing, which I had been sort of out of for 30 years, I realized that even in the 30 years since I had my own children, the pressures on parents had become just insanely intense, and on children as well. And I think, importantly, on preschools. So as someone who spends a lot of time talking to people in preschools, I was increasingly hearing preschool teachers who were saying they felt under terrible pressure, both from parents and from policymakers, to turn preschool into something that was more and more academic. And the reason was this kind of carpentry parenting model that we want our children to come out to be the children who go to Stanford.
Or Cal.
At the same time, as a faculty member at Cal, I think we were seeing some of the same kinds of things that you're seeing. One of the things I say in the book is, you think about different kinds of gardening. Imagine the kind of gardening that isn't just sort of having a big meadow where lots of diversity and variability thrives, which I think is what human childhood is like. But think about it if you were raising an orchid, where you really do want to really control what happens. Imagine that if that orchid had consciousness, they might sound a bit like some of the undergraduates that we deal with, where they, part of the time they'd be saying, I am just the most fabulous orchid. Look at me. I'm so great. And the other part of the time they'd be saying, did someone leave the door open? I think there might be a draft. I'm not sure. Is someone going to please come and feed me and put more water on? And you know, that's perhaps a bit of a caricature, but I think it gets at the potential drawbacks of the parenting model, aside from the fact that it drives parents crazy. And I think it should be both liberating and reassuring to parents that They don't have to be involved in this kind of competitive work, goal-oriented parenting business to be marvelous parents. And in fact, to be a marvelous parent is something is very different from the kind of work-oriented picture that we have from parenting.
Well, you actually say, quote, parenting is not a kind of work. It's a kind of love, mm-hmm. which is beautiful. What the heck does it mean, though?
Yeah.
I mean, how does a parent who wants to not do the work of parenting, but to love a kid toward this ultimate independence, how do you sort of fashion love into raising a human to adulthood?
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that, and I mentioned this in the book, it's interesting that, you know, we don't child our parents, and we don't wive our husbands, and we don't even really friend our friends, even on Facebook. We don't think of those as being goal-directed work activities that have a particular kind of outcome. And I think there's a reason why that word parenting started showing up in the 70s, which is that for the first time in human history, literally the first time in human history, people were having children who had never taken care of a child. For most of human history, by the time you were 11, mm-hmm. you had taken care of lots
siblings.
Of children.
Mm-hmm.
You'd had siblings, you'd had extended families, you'd had lots of opportunities for caregiving. And now you could be in your 30s, have spent a lot of time working and a lot of time going to school, but not much time caregiving. I mean, even teenage babysitters have sort of disappeared mm-hmm. because the teenage babysitters are spending so much time preparing for their SATs, they don't have time to be babysitters.
Or because we're so obsessed with safety, we can't imagine letting a 14-year-old look after our
kids. Yeah, that's right. I mean, for most of history, 11-year-olds were the ones who were kind of that was part of life as an 11-year-old mm-hmm. was taking care of younger children. And that was a way that you could just discover, the same way you discover about love, for husbands and, you know, love for boys and girls when you're 15 or 16, you could discover something about what this kind of love, this love of children was like. Mm. So I'm not sure what the solution is. I do think part of the problem was this strange circumstance where people had such a strong model of you work and you have outcomes and you have benchmarks and then imported that to this new issue of caring for children, partly because they didn't have the experience of caring for children. Mm. But I do think children are really good at teaching you. Children, you know, one thing that people will say in the context of the book is, I might have thought that I had control over the children until I had them, mm-hmm. but they rapidly persuaded
me
that wasn't true. And I think parents have this kind of real kind of double consciousness where part of them is saying, you know, this doesn't make any sense. These children are all different from one another. They're unpredictable. I don't know what they're going to do next, and I look around the world and I see that it's very hard to know what makes people come out to be the way that they do, and yet at the same time they feel as if they're under this tremendous pressure to shape their children to come out a particular way.
Right. So let's just assume as a given that all parents love their children and want the best for them. I'm willing to assume that for the sake of argument, and I think it's probably true for 99.99% mm-hmm. of all parents. That is, we are trying our best. We're trying to do the right thing. We're consuming all of these parenting books, yours and mine and others, and listening to webcasts and podcasts and all of that, desperate to be good at this task that seems more complicated than ever. And when we're in a community of a certain means, and I'm looking at you, Palo Alto, and those of you listening in the Bay Area, we tend to think we parents, in order to achieve that goal of the successful kid, you know, providing the kid everything we can, we've sort of gone the extra mile. We're now trying to control and engineer outcomes. We'd rather put her hand on the toy mm-hmm. to put the block, you know, into the right hole to make the noise, you know, than sit on our hands and let our toddler go through the excruciating task of figuring it out herself. You know, we know sort of intellectually, like, that's how a human learns. You tell us based on the science, that's how a human learns. And yet we can't help ourselves. We seem to be robbing our kids of their agency, of mm-hmm. the sort of chance to be the actor that acts upon things in their own life. Tell me what you can about agency and about autonomy. You know, why is that? If I'm right that we're robbing our kids of agency, or whatever it might be called in a psychological sense, I'm not a psychologist, you are. If we're robbing our kids of this chance to be, capital B, where does this lead? Where does this go? Who are they going to become?
Well, I think that's an open question. We'll have to sort of see what they become. But I think for sure that we can say that the act of being a parent has become difficult in ways that aren't necessary. So at the very least, you know, I think there are issues about the fact that our undergraduates seem so fragile in a way that they haven't been before. But even if that weren't true, it would still be true that the very experience of caring for children, such a deep, profound part of our life as human beings, has become fraught and difficult and painful for people. It's treated as if it was a kind of test of your virtue and your capacities in a way that makes life kind of miserable for parents and for children. It doesn't make life better. It doesn't make it richer. It doesn't set up a situation in which parents and children can thrive. Now, it's important to say that, and this may not be a coincidence, that at the same time that this is happening in middle-class families, 20% of American children are growing up in poverty, and that number is going up. Mm-hmm. So for those children and those parents, they have problems coming at the other end. But even for middle-class parents, if you think about, you know, the kind of context in which we evolved in a context where there were big extended families with many, many, many people invested in caring for children. And from a child's perspective, many, many models, many different ways of being in the world, a way of looking around and saying, oh, grandmom is different from dad, who's different from mom, who's different from cousins, who's different from older siblings. Here's all these variables. Here's all these possibilities for the way that I could be in the world. And I think we can point to some things like really great early childhood programs like the Child Study Center, or one of my favorite examples is children's museums. There are institutions that have started to develop that can kind of take some of the place of that village where people can sit, children can do things that are rich, parents can talk to one another, but it's not like school. It's not like here's a particular kind of outcome. And I think we should be thinking much more about how can we get a community of caring grown-ups interacting with children rather than what's the technique that we can use to make our children come out better in the end. Mm. Another reason why I like the garden metaphor is I think something like this kind of happened with gardening, and maybe this helps to think about the example. One of the things that we know is that at one point people thought that the best way to do agriculture was to try to control outcomes as much as you possibly could. You know, get that biggest potato with the most fertilizer and protect it from any possible harm with the most pesticides. And what we know now is you might get a big potato out of that, but that is not a system that's going to be robust when things change. And one thing that we know about human beings is that things change. Mm. So instead, having lots of variety, lots of possibilities, lots of different things in the garden, things that thrive in one year and perish in the other year, that's a much better strategy for being able to be robust over time. Another metaphor maybe to mention in the valley, although I'm always a little hesitant about this because I'm not sure I want parents to think this way, but if you think about even something like a VC, right? I mean, they know, even in the hard-nosed business world, they know, look, we can't tell how things are going to work. What we do is say, here's lots and lots of possibilities. Let's give them all a start, and then let's see what comes out. And that's a much better strategy than trying to say, all right, I'm going to take this company and I'm going to shape it to come out a particular way.
You know, two thoughts. One is that our kids, of course, are not investments. You know, we act as if they're the stock in the stock market and we are all concerned about the return on our investment, like a VC might be. But I take your point that they are looking at many possibilities, they're investing in a lot of different things, and ultimately they're going to see what takes. I also can't now shake the image of, like, young adults as big potatoes. But back toward something you said a few moments ago, back to something, and then I've got questions from the audience I'm going to read. You mentioned the income disparity. You mentioned that some kids are being raised the way we're talking, and then perhaps the other end of the spectrum socioeconomically, things are quite different. And I want to raise a question with you that kind of speaks to that. In the field of psychology, there's a new field called emerging adulthood. You've already made the point through your beautiful presentation that we humans have a longer period of childhood than any other animal, than any other mammal. That's because we have big brains and it takes time for those big brains to develop. And, you know, it's like big brain equals long childhood equals much smarter. So some people these days are saying, you know, this extended adolescence into the 20s, you know, this emerging adulthood is actually natural and normal. We're living to 100. Why shouldn't adolescence go till 30? You know, I think those of us raising teenagers right now are like, are you kidding me? You know, like, please tell me. I love them. And I'm really looking forward to when they'll be on their own. But here's my question whenever I hear that. People say, well, you know, the prefrontal cortex hasn't fully developed until a young, you know, till a child, till a young man or woman is 24 or 25. Therefore, they need all of this coddling and protection parents doing for them at Berkeley, at Stanford, at other places, in the workplace. You know, to which I say, wait a minute. Nobody is yet saying kids for whom the U.S. military is the best choice after high school, no one's yet saying those kids lack the prefrontal cortex function to make that decision or put their lives on the line for the ideals in which we believe as Americans. Now, who tends to make that choice? Poor kids, working class kids, children of immigrants, kids who would be the first in their family to go to college, children of color, disproportionately choose that, not solely. My point is, if this is a stage of life, if emerging adulthood is legit, and we are moving as humans toward a much longer childhood and adolescence, and adulthood really does start at 30 or 35, why is nobody yet saying that about kids who are poor, working class, in underserved communities? Or do you think the emerging adulthood movement within psychology is a load of
Well, I think, you know,
potatoes.
What's happened is that we can sort of descriptively say that there's this the trade-off that I talked about that evolution seems to have solved with childhood, this trade-off between exploring and exploiting, between being able to be in many, many different environments and being able to be really well designed to cope with one. Those are trade-offs that happen throughout our life and have happened throughout human history. One way that you could think about the extension, you know, even something like what we do. I mean, even universities, in a way, are a way of keeping you in a more protected state in which you can learn more. And you know, some of us become scientists and faculty members where we stay in that childlike state for our entire lives. So there is something to be said for that. On the other hand, one of the things that we know from the neuroscience is the way that frontal lobes mature is by being used. That's true about our brains in general.
Right.
So it's by accomplishing things, by getting more skills, that we actually get more skills. We get a brain that's more skilled. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, I talk about school-age children. I think there's a very good argument to be made that, you know, give school-age children a skill that they can perform autonomously by themselves and do well at it, and they're really happy. I mean, they'll love sports and music and things like that, where you actually can become skilled.
Yeah.
And science ought to be the same thing. But we don't even let our students become skilled scientists until they're in graduate school.
Mm.
We don't actually give them a chance to practice the skills that we need in science. So I do think there's some of these trade-offs about exploration on the one hand and skill and exploitation on the other hand. But certainly by the time most children are, you know, not even adolescents, but even school-age children are starting to accomplish some of those skills of being able to take care of themselves, to being able to cook, being able to clean, being able to do chores. And for most of human history, by the time children were 7 or 8, those were the kinds of things that they were doing.
So let's turn to the schooling environment. And now I'm turning to the questions that have come from our amazing audience. A huge number of questions. We'll do our best to get through them. This comes from Mark Vicente, former teacher at Gunn High School here in Palo Alto. He says, I've noticed that the aspects of modern parenting that you so accurately describe are coming to increasingly govern the way our modern high schools are run, from required grade reporting every 3 weeks, or I'd add more frequently, to all-day access to students via cell phone, to homework assignments delivered by computer rather than in person, to parents writing, editing, and proofing their children's papers. I know, right? What can we do about this?
Well, I mean, again, you know, we have to decide how we're going to organize those schools and what we're going to do as parents. Again, I think we can point to examples. The high school that my youngest son went to is Athenian High School near Berkeley, and one of the things that they do is part of the kind of Outward Bound program, is they send the kids into the desert for a month in their senior year. So they actually, the kids actually go on either to the mountains or the desert. They have what they call the Athenian wilderness experience, and they're learning to be able to go off, which includes spending a day, a day or two by themselves with obviously enough adults around so that if they break a leg, there's a helicopter, but mostly other high schoolers.
Does and that still happen?
Yeah, that still happens, and that's the kind of pinnacle of experience for the kids in that high school. They know that that's going to be the thing that will be really the final exam that they're preparing for. So, I mean, I think we have examples like that of ways that we could organize our educational system that would encourage that kind of autonomy and exploration.
And as a follow-on to that, do you think that homework in primary grades is a carpentry project that impacts exploring in the gardening time negatively?
Well, I think there's, you know, if you look at many places in Europe, for example, Finland, Scotland is just talking about trying to adopt this. Their picture is early childhood education goes till 7. So you have the sort of things that you could see in that picture, the kind of kindergarten, is actually something that's going on till kids are 7 or 8 years old. They're exploring and they're gardening and so forth. And even academic instruction isn't showing up until, what would be second or third grade for us, let alone having a bunch of homework assignments that you're taking home in that time, in that after-school time. Another kind of...
How is that kid going to get into Cal?
Yeah, well,
or Stanford, if you're not getting instruction at age 4.
Yeah, if you look at the interesting thing is then if you look at how well those kids do on the international comparisons,
they're
the Finnish kids are killing us.
Yeah.
It's not like our system is doing
us any favors.
Yeah,
right. To your point about Finland, we could add in any number of other countries that seem to have not fallen into the parenting trap, although I think some have. Is parenting a uniquely American phenomenon, or is it more universal? Have you studied that, or do you know people who have?
Well, it's the way it always is in America. So the great developmental psychologist, Jean Piaget, said that whenever he went to talk to audiences, there was what he called the question américaine. He said there was always some American in the audience who would say, yes, Mr. Piaget, that's really interesting, everything you're saying about what the kids are doing, but how can we get them to do it faster? And that was the question américaine, and I suspect that's kind of the question américaine across a lot of different areas. So I do think it's become most intense in America, but as is often the case with things in America, that has become an issue in other places as well. But there's also pushback. As I said, in Scotland now there's a campaign to try to have something that looks more like the Finnish system. And of course, it should be said, I was just doing a talk at the Edinburgh Festival, and I was talking with a bunch of Europeans and talking to someone in Ireland, and I said, well, of course, you have public support for education all the way through. And he said, oh, no, we have to cobble things together. He said, it's not until the children are 18 months that we actually start having public, federally funded support for child care.
Oh, what a hardship, yeah.
And I said, oh, okay.
I'm resisting making some kind of joke that will be regarded as inappropriate in these times. Okay. We've talked about the schooling system that might be a form of carpentry rather than gardening, with this obsession with grades and perfecting scores and parents doing homework. Someone else has written about the fact that many people in our community these days seem to have a problem with kids walking to school alone, playing in their front or backyard alone. Nationally, we've had examples of parents who've had the police called on them because they're, quote unquote, neglecting their child because their child is doing the basic things that everyone in this audience did when we were 7, 8, 9, 10, or 11. Now it's seen as neglect for a child to be out in the world alone. So this person is asking, how do we grow adults / autonomous kids when society appears to be moving in the direction of not just carpentry, but making sure every single moment is kind of bubble wrapped and safe?
Yeah. I mean, I think, as I said, when I looked at this film, it was interesting. I wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal about the fact that, it seemed like they were had nails and saws in this preschool, and I felt very nervous about it. You know, I thought, oh no, I'm going to get into a lot of trouble with people saying, oh, you're saying you should give saws to 4-year-olds. What actually happened, and this is partly the Wall Street Journal audience, was I got all these comments from 70-year-olds, rural 70-year-olds in America.
I
said, of course, you know, the dangerous thing is give them a blunt knife. You want to give them a sharp knife. Here's the story about how when I got my first sharp knife, and there's a historian who's just written an interestingly parallel book looking at the history of American childhood.
Yeah.
And it's real, again, it's very recent. American children were famous for being independent and being
Chudikoff?
And
Howard
being
Chudikoff?
Resilient. No, I'll get it in a minute. Okay. I'll get it in a minute. This is, being a grandmother is marvelous, but it also involves that you lose your memory.
That's my excuse. I'm only 49.
So, you know, we've actually moved from having children who were famous for their independence to having children who are particularly protected.
Infamously dependent.
And, you know, it's ironic that we actually have to have, you know, something like free-range parenting as a parenting form to be able to...
That's Lenore Skenazy's word.
To be able, which is, you know, I'm in favor of, but it is sort of odd that we have to have a practice to be able to have kids go out and walk home from school. But again, I mean, one says that easily, but that, of course, you know, the mystical where we're all on the street and waiting for the lights to come on, and that depended on having a cadre of adults who were there in the background. And I think what we have to do is figure out ways that we can recreate that culture where there's a community, there are adults who are there in the background but aren't shaping every minute. I mean, let me give you another example of something that we know about from the developmental literature. Kids getting together to put games together is an incredibly powerful cognitive activity because it means you have to figure out what the rules are, you have to negotiate, you have to coordinate, you have to be with equals and say, we're going to do this rather than that. And in the days of Wobble and Hopscotch and all the games that children actually invented, it wasn't just that they played the games, which is a healthy thing, but they had to invent the games with no grown-ups around. And there's this marvelous childhood culture of those kinds of invented games. And now, I mean, we put our children in soccer practice or basketball practice or something, and it's good they get lots of physical exercise, but they don't get a chance to actually make up basketball or make up soccer.
You know, the way that I put it is that we've, instead of allowing them to play freely, which Peter Gray, who's one of the gurus of play in our country, has written about, Peter Gray says, if you want to know what free play is, if there's an adult there, that's not free play.
Yeah.
And instead of letting kids play freely, we put them in this cage of enrichment.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my perspective. All right. One of our audience members has sort of a follow-up to your Finland point. Finland and other similar countries don't have levels of poverty or inequality like we do. How does the garden help those children who return to the cave, I think this says, return to the cave every day?
Yeah. Again, I mean, that's a really serious issue. But again, we have lots of models. I mean, most places in the world have figured out that providing enriched public preschool for all children is a way of guaranteeing that you have a healthy, thriving society. I mean, this isn't just like an eccentric thing that a few crazy liberal Scandinavians do. I mean, this is something that's kind of the baseline. And we have better social science data about the success of those programs than I think we have about essentially any other program in social science. 30 years ago, I would have said, you know, it's so hard to tell whether a program like that actually has good outcomes or not. It's really complicated. We have really, really good data on the effects of those interventions, and we have it come over and over and over again. And it's just one of those, you know, I have to ask other people about why America hasn't adopted that in a broad sense. And it's bipartisan. It's something that people from lots of different traditions, rural and urban, can agree on, but
it hasn't taken root.
There's some strange reasons
idiosyncratic reasons why it hasn't taken root. So that's kind of a no-brainer. That's not like some wonderful creative solution. That's something that most people in most of the world already do to try to solve those problems of inequality and poverty.
So early childhood education is in some ways the perfect sort of garden plot.
Yeah.
In which to begin raising a child.
And in fact, I think a lot of people would say, and I would be among them, what we need to do is not make preschools more like schools. What we need to do is make schools more like preschools. Preschools are...
Everybody's side is a big...
Yeah. I should say I went to Davos, to the World Economic Forum, to talk about this, and I was in a panel with the Chancellor of Oxford University, which was my alma mater. And I said, you know, my experience in Oxford was actually quite a lot like preschool. I mean, basically what happened is that they let you do whatever it is that you wanted, and then there were tutors around who were kind of resources. And I looked at him a little nervously about that, and he said, oh, that's great. I'm going to say this to all of my faculty. And it's true, you know, the very best graduate science programs, you know, Berkeley or Stanford or Caltech or MIT, they're like gardens. They're places where we want people to explore. And, you know, it's no coincidence that places like Pixar or Google, they're self-consciously, they want their employees to be able to explore. And that looks much more like what we typically see in preschool than what we typically see in schools. And after all, schools were designed for a particular time at a particular place. It sounds mean, but in a sense, they were designed to make robots, in the sense that the skills that schools were designed to instill in the 19th century were skills that robots can perform now. Those aren't the skills that we need if we're going to advance in the 20th century. And ironically, the preschools that are under tremendous pressure to become more school-like actually give us a better model: play, creativity, exploration, innovation, for the kinds of things that children are really designed to do.
Yeah. You know, I heard Stuart Brown from the National Institutes of Play say this, I think, in a TED Talk. He said, you know, the engineers at NASA Ames, Boeing, Jet Propulsion Labs, they don't want to hire the top graduate from the top engineering school, per se. They want to hire somebody who tinkered as a child.
Yeah.
You know, that tinkering mentality, having the chance to tinker, to pull stuff apart, to put stuff together, to put something different together out of the stuff you just took apart. You know, that's the mindset, you know, that makes somebody persist through engineering's most difficult problems, not somebody who's been sort of grade drumming.
Yeah, let me mention an example of something. Again, you know, I want to be positive about this. Maker fairs are another, like children's museums, are another example of an institution that just seems to sort of bubbled up from below, that provides a wonderful example of giving children a rich environment with lots of autonomy, letting them create, letting them figure out what to do, what to do themselves. So that's another positive, like the children's museums or the science museums or the really good preschools. You can a positive thing that you can point to as an example.
Good. You know, at the start of our talk, I referenced the fact that you're a grandma. You've mentioned Augie. I know you also have Georgie, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any more besides the two I've read about in your wonderful book. But I want to turn now to someone's question that really invites you to think about your own kids who are now raising children, your grandchildren. Think about your own grandchildren. This is the question. Being a gardener takes more faith than being a carpenter parent. You have a lack of control. And the environment around you has a lot to do with how you parent, how your kids grow up. What advice do you have for parents who theoretically believe in gardening, but find it hard to fight against the mainstream of carpentry, which is so endemic in your community across the bay and in ours here?
Yeah. Well, I always say, you know, the only real piece of advice I have is skip the children, go straight to the grandchildren. that would be my one serious piece of advice. But
how do we do that?
But maybe, you know, I think being one of the many fantastic things about being a grandparent is that it can give you this kind of broader perspective, because you've gone through this process of having children yourself. You can see other people having had the process, seeing people have children. And again, something that we don't do enough is have parents in touch with older people who've had children themselves. One of the things that I think is a real tragedy in our society is that we have, you know, many, many people who would love to be grandparents, but their grandchildren are far away. And then we have many, many parents who would love to have the help and support and knowledge of someone who's gone through this before, but their parents are far, far away. And there are some programs to try to bring together communities of people who've gone through this before and who can help think about give advice, give examples, sort of say that things are going to be okay in the end. And I also think that, you know, one of the things that's actually really morally profound about having children, and the last chapter of the book is about the sort of philosophical ethics of having children, is that we can give them up. And they don't always come out the way that we expect them to. They rarely come out the way we expect them to, and we love them anyway. That's the thing that makes parental love such a deep, morally profound kind of love. You know, if what we really wanted was to have children who would come out to be, you know, the children who were happier or smarter or whatever, we'd go around and try and find the babies that were like that and ignore the rest of them and just, yeah, nuts, right? One of the things that's so amazing, an amazing experience as a grandmother again is, you know, that Georgie and Augie and Addie, who's, by the way, is the new baby, in a way, it doesn't matter to me what their properties are. I mean, you know, they're perfect and wonderful, magnificent in every possible way, even though they're completely different from each other. They're completely different from my children. And that's a part of the evolutionary program of adulthood, the fact that we can feel that kind of unconditional, transparent love for another human being. I think that's a really morally deep part of childhood and part of being a parent. And I think if we could focus more on that, on the actual sort of mindful experience of being a parent in the moment and the good and bad that comes with that, instead of always thinking about what's going to happen down the line when we don't know what's going to happen down the line. That's the whole point. I think that would be a way of sort of shifting our focus in a way that enables you to do this gardening. And another thing that I think comes out of the science that's important is children learn best when they're with adults who are doing the things that adults care about the most. And part of what the parenting view has been is there's like this all this special stuff that you're supposed to do as a parent, which is not the stuff that you would do just because you're you. And I think there's a lot of evidence that for children, things like just watching the people around them do the things that they do skillfully, that's the best way for children to learn, watching and participating, doing things like gardening or cooking or going shopping. Those are the contexts in which children are learning the most, and children are getting the skills that they need.
So often when we're hyper-hovering over our kids, we're actually depriving them of the chance to observe us in a healthy, vibrant adult life with a hobby or some work that we enjoy and so on. We're sort of not modeling.
That's right.
How wonderful it is to be around people who love what they're doing.
And you want to hang around? You can hang me while I'm doing the thing that's really important to me, too.
We have like a nanosecond left, slightly more. So I'm going to just try to get to a couple key questions. One is about ADHD and one is about social media. Mm-hmm. And I think these are both examples of things that sort of have intervened. We might be the best gardener in the world, but oh no, our kid has a diagnosis of ADD or ADHD. You know, what is your view of ADHD, this question? And then social pressures for teens have multiplied with social media. How can we garden in a social media context?
Yeah. So again, I have chapters about both of these things in the book, since we've only got a nanosecond left. But I think there's actually quite a bit of evidence that, again, go back to this idea about variability, that people have always varied tremendously in things like how focused their attention is or how widespread their attention is. And for most of human history, that wasn't problematic. It was just part of the range of people with different skills and different abilities and different ways of being in the world, which is a good thing. It's part of the reason why we have children. But in a very hyper-focused school environment, that natural variability turns into something that becomes problematic. And there's quite a lot of evidence, for instance, that when you start having standardized testing and accountability in schools, the rates of diagnosis of ADHD are going up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's quite, now again, you know, it's a spectrum, so that means that there have always been children who are at one end who are really endangering themselves or having problems or you know, really are where it really is difficult. But it isn't like, you know, measles where you could say, yeah, either you have the ADHD virus or you don't have the ADHD virus. And on the technology front, I'm interested to discover more and more, most psychologists are much more optimistic about this than I think the culture at large is.
Oh, thank
so,
God.
In fact, I'm just going to write another piece about this. And it's interesting for me because when I wrote the book, I have a chapter about technology that's pretty positive and optimistic. Again, part of this evolutionary story is that each generation has this period where they can try to master everything that's new in their generation that wasn't there in the previous generation. And, you know, each previous generation basically, as I say in the book, feels that the day before you were born was Eden and the day after you're born is Mad Max. So the technology, even the word technology is kind of funny, right? So telephones and televisions and carpenter tables and woven fabric don't strike us as being technology because, of course, that's all the stuff that we had when we were growing up. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that we, each generation of children figures out how to deal with the environment that they are dealing with and that they do that in this kind of open, flexible way that looks very different when you're trying to approach, say, an iPhone from the perspective of a 60-year-old as opposed to a 4-year-old like my son. So I'm actually, now maybe this time will be different from all the other times in human history when we were sure that our children were, whatever it was that they were doing was going to lead to disaster. But I don't think so. And I think there's an increasing consensus among the scientists and psychologists who are studying the matter that you know, there's plenty of things to be worried about. One of the things I say sometimes about being a parent and now a grandparent is we should have like a worry bank where all the things that you worry about that don't actually happen, you could kind of put the worry in the worry bank, and then the next time there's something to worry about, you could say, okay, no, I already worried about that. I already worried about that thing that didn't happen. I don't have to worry about this thing. But there are plenty of things to worry about, like the fact that 20% of American children are growing up in poverty, and worse than that, growing up in isolation and difficulty. That's something that you could definitely worry about. Mm-hmm. Worrying, I think, about social media, not so much.
So humility, worrying less. I'm not going to ask you for a how-to list because you're a research scientist and you're trying not to be prescriptive about what parents should do. But one tip, if your daughter or son-in-law, I'm not sure who your kids are, but if they came to you and said, Mom, one tip, what's the one thing I need to be sure I'm doing with Augie, Addie, and Georgie, what would you say? One thing.
So this is my 3-word answer. Love them, muddle through, and hope for the best.
Amen. Let's give Dr. Gopnik a round of applause. Thank you.
Terrific. I hope you enjoyed this program even half as much as I did. It was brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest. And again, we would like to thank Dr. Allison Gopnik, Professor of Psychology at UC Berkeley, Dr. Julie Lithcott-Hames, former Dean, a freshman at Stanford, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now, this meeting, you didn't know it was a meeting, this meeting is adjourned.